Blog Talk Radio.
And I'm here, man. Are y'all ready for the fire talk? Low down on the biz and uplift the dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
Listen right along. This is straight off the press, the remix, fresh with no prior song.
Oh.
Supplying y'all with the certified thoughtful.
Yeah.
To give a piece to the piece, it's time to call blow.
Yeah.
The raspberry wind is fragrant, and flavorful. Insatiable eardrums taste the radio. Here can't be beat, the clash with me. That'll leave all your doors and all half the week.
What?
Positive and motivational stack to see successful guests promote herself massively. BlogTalkRadio.com/ The remix Fridays at 10 p.m. Eastern. Support the sister with a great reason. I must insist, don't miss it this evening. Peace, man.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Remix on this very, very, very special Saturday day. Today, right here live in The Remix, we have the Howard University Law student who will be here talking about the Fair Housing Act and all of those things. If you're interested in buying a home or maybe yourself you have a home, you'll get to find out more about special home buying programs, how to shop for a home, how to make an offer, all of those great things. We're going to get started right here live in The Remix right after these messages.
La 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 la, The Remix. Hey, this is Baby Blue. And remember, if nothing else moves you, life will.
My people.
Yes.
My people.
Yes.
The foundation of the United States rests on the sweat of my people. Every enemy of the USA has had to face my people on the front line.
People, my people are dying, and we see it all the time. Don't know where our future would be if he's not here. How do we stay strong?
There's a greater master plan. We need to know our history. We were kings and queens of the greatest dynasty.
My people,
don't you get better?
My people rise, my
oh,
people
yeah.
rise.
Welcome to The Remix. We are live here with Howard Law students. They will be joining us right here live in The Remix. And for those of you over here in The Remix, if you would like to come join us on this forum, simply go to www.blogtalkradio.com/The Remix and come on in. All right. So let me go ahead and bring the callers on the line with us. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Remix.
Hi, Miss Lou.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you guys so much for coming on this Saturday morning and sharing all of your information with us here. Okay, we're going to start out. Let's start out with you, Lois, and why don't you introduce yourself to everyone out there listening. And while you're introducing yourself, tell us a little bit about what made you choose Howard Law School as your place of being.
Okay. First of all, my name is Lois Hanshaw. I'm from Montgomery, Alabama. I chose Howard University when I was actually an undergrad. Howard was the law school that I originally wanted to go to, and I attended a accepted students reception, and one of the things about the law school is that they have mural pictures from every year that has graduated from the law school, and so being able to walk around and see a tangible representation of the legacy that you would be a part of was just something that really excited me about the law school, and that's ultimately why I chose to come.
Okay, wonderful. And who else do we have on the line with us?
Hi, my name is Charles McLaurin.
Okay.
I'm a third-year law student at Howard, and I chose Howard because I wanted to learn the law through a civil rights lens. And similar to Lois, I also wanted to be part of history. And just learning law through a civil rights perspective, I thought this would be the best institution to get that.
Okay, wonderful. And who else is with us today?
Hi, I'm Jaylen Johnson.
Okay, Jaylen, and why did you choose Howard Law School?
Oh, yes, of course. I chose Howard Law School actually because I went to Howard for undergrad. And so going to Howard and having had that experience and going out kind of into the working world, I really wanted to come back and get back to Howard because it's just a place that I've always loved since I've been in higher education. And so I couldn't imagine going anywhere else.
Okay, beautiful, beautiful. And so today our center of focus is going to be something that has been the focus in our country over the last couple of months, and we're going to be talking about the housing market, correct?
Correct.
All right. Well, this is the part that I get to let you guys do what you do.
Okay. Well, first we're just going to kind of focus on what's currently going on in the housing market. It's a really good time to buy if you're in the market. Housing prices are down. Interest rates are down. The only issue is that, you know, with the economic crisis that's going on, getting money from lenders is more of an issue than it was previously. But if you are able to get a loan and you qualify, then it's definitely a good time to go ahead and buy. One of the incentives to buy is the Obama's new tax credit, and it's different from the previous tax credit that was in place. So I'll talk about the previous credit before I go into Obama's. The previous credit was a maximum credit of up to $7,500 that you could get, you know, through your taxes if you purchased a house between April 8th of 2008 or December 31st of 2008. And the way the credit operated was it was similar to a 15-year interest-free loan. So you purchase the house and then you would get the credit on your, you can get on your 2008 or your 2009 tax return, but you have to pay it back. So within a year of your purchase of the home, you have to start paying back the however much amount of the credit that you got, you have to pay that in equal installments for up to 15 years. So it would be 15 equal installments. The difference between that previous credit and the current credit is that the current credit is up to $8,000, or it's 10% of the home's value, whichever is less. But that applies to houses that were purchased basically beginning in 2009. So between January 1st and December 1st, you can either get that credit or the 10% of your home's value. And you can get that on your 2008 or your 2009 tax return. But in order to qualify, there's income requirements or income maximums in order to be able to qualify, and your adjusted gross income can't be more than $75,000 for singles or $150,000 for joint filers. And so if you qualify for that, then you can get the credit and you don't have to pay it back. You also have to remain in the home for 3 years in order to qualify for the credit. And to qualify as a first-time home buyer, you, or if you're buying the house with your spouse, you can't have owned another main home during the 3 years prior to the date of purchase. So the new law is separate from the $7,500 credit that I just spoke about. So they're two different things, and it depends on when you purchased your home as to which type of credit that you'll get.
Right.
So that's just currently what's going on, one of the big home ownership things that's going on in the market.
Right. And this is something that definitely, can it be taken advantage no matter what state you live in the United States?
Yes, it's a national housing credit.
Okay. It's a national housing credit. Okay, that sounds good. All right.
Okay. So now we're going to just talk about, Charles is going to take over now.
Okay. So first we want to think about how much you can afford when you think about becoming a homeowner for the first time. What you can afford depends on your income, your credit rating, current monthly expenses, down payment, and the interest rates. There are online calculators that can help you figure out how much you can afford, and they could also help you weigh buying versus renting and home economics. However, the best is to visit a lender to find out for sure exactly how much you can afford. First, you really need to check your credit reports. Your credit reports, of course, are an ongoing look at how you manage your finances. And you need to know exactly what your credit reports say about your financial history before you apply for a mortgage, because reports can play a really important role in the mortgage approval process and in determining the interest rate and other loan terms that a lender offers you. Your debt and credit history are really important considerations in this decision, and lenders will look more favorably on candidates who have a history of paying their credit card bills, vehicle loans, student loans in a timely manner, and those whose debt does not exceed more than 30% to 40% of their income. So if you haven't looked at your credit reports, you might be surprised at their contents, because errors are quite common. So you can check the accuracy of the credit reports at www.annualcreditreport.com. Next, if you need help with your down payment or closing costs, you really should think about some home buying programs in your state. Each state has different home buying programs that provide free or low-cost counseling services for buying, renting, defaults, foreclosures, credit issues, and reverse mortgages. They also provide advice on avoiding predatory lending. So it's a really good idea to take advantage of these home buying programs in your state. Next, you want to consider housing counselors who can help you figure out how to manage and pay off your debt and start saving for that down payment. Again, there are housing counselors in every state that can be located through the HUD website. Most experts would advise prospective buyers to keep in mind certain factors when predicting and estimating the cost to owning a home. Now, while the mortgage payment is certainly the major element of a homeowner's monthly housing expense, there are a number of other factors that future buyers should keep in mind when predicting and estimating these costs. For instance, is the type of mortgage, is the interest rates, utilities, closing costs, costs for repair, property taxes, and homeowner insurance. So I'm going to say one or two sentences about each of these factors and how they should play a part in your considerations. First, the type of mortgage. Today's buyers have a host of mortgage options from which to choose and can select the package that best suits their situations. These include interest-only loans, adjustable-rate mortgages, and the traditional 15- or 30-year fixed-rate loans. You should talk to your lender to find out what type of mortgage is best for you. Second, the homeowner should consider the interest rates. It really is a buyer's market, like Lois said earlier out there, so don't be afraid to negotiate hard with your lender to secure a more desirable rate. Third, you want to consider the cost of utilities. What kind of cable or satellite services will you use? How much electricity and water will the house demand? A good seller should provide 12 months worth of utility information so that you know what cost to expect.
Right.
Now,
go ahead.
Next, you want to consider closing costs. There are a number of other fees that must be paid when completing a real estate transaction, and these closing costs include points, taxes, title insurance, financing costs, and the services of professionals, and that usually range between 2% and 7% of the purchase price. The fifth factor you want to consider is the cost of repairs and decorations. Does the house need any repairs or renovations? You really want to find this out before when you calculate exactly how much you can afford. Typically, the seller will bear the cost of any major repairs or improvements prior to the sale, but not always. So be ready to find a few things you'll need to repair and consider how much decorating you'll want to do to make the house your own. The next factor you should consider is property taxes. Property taxes are levied by the various municipalities in which your property is located. But the tricky element is to predict with the home purchase, especially because the housing costs go up so dramatically in recent years. The final factor you want to consider is homeowner insurance. Covering your home in case of loss, damage, or injury in your property is always a really good idea. There are policies designed for different types of homes based on the number of families occupying them and whether the owner is on the premises. So next, I think Galen is going to talk about knowing your rights.
Okay. All right, Galen, and you can talk to us about knowing the rights. I'll let everybody know if you're just joining us here in the forum. We are speaking with the students of Howard Law School, and we are talking about the housing, everything to do with housing here. So get your questions ready. We'll be taking some questions and some calls soon. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, again, I'm Jaylen Johnson, and basically, after you determine like how much you can afford and what you want to do with that financial rise, you want to consider your rights, because oftentimes when we're shopping for a home, that's something that's not always at the forefront of our minds, but it's something that's very important because it can really determine what you get in value for your home, because you want to have your rights asserted so that you're not buying a home that you don't necessarily want to buy or getting a loan that isn't the best rate. So there are several federal acts that are very important in buying a home, but I'm going to talk about two today, and that's the Fair Housing Act and the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. And so first, for the Fair Housing Act, basically the act just prohibits discrimination and intimidation of people in their homes, and it protects people against discrimination based on race, color, national origin, religion, gender, familial status, and handicap. And specifically, it's designed to prohibit that discrimination in the sale and rental of a dwelling unit. And it applies to really everyone involved in selling or renting a house. It applies to the person who's actually selling the house. It applies to the mortgage broker. It applies to the lender. Anyone who's involved in you purchasing your house, they have to abide by the laws and the regulations of the Fair Housing Act. And well, just really quickly, some examples of what would be prohibited by the act would be anyone refusing to sell you their home. And also, I just want to make a quick note, though we're talking about home buying and home ownership today, the Fair Housing Act also applies to renters. So if there's anyone out there who's a renter, you also have these same rights, and the Fair Housing Act applies to you as well. But right now, as far as in relation to purchasing a home, some prohibited acts are refusing to sell the house, refusing to negotiate for housing if someone refuses to do that, and setting different terms, conditions, or privileges for the sale. For example, if an African-American person gets different terms for the same home and they're in the same similar situation as a Caucasian person and they get different terms, if the Caucasian person gets the different terms, it doesn't necessarily have to be a minority. It just has to be based on that particular class. So making the housing unavailable would also be prohibited. Falsely denying the housing, falsely denying it and saying that it's not available, or falsely denying it for inspection. We'll talk about inspection later on in our discussion. And refusing to make a loan, like I mentioned earlier, lenders are also subject to the act. Imposing different terms and conditions for the loan, for example, if the interest rate for one group is higher than for another group, or the in one area is higher as opposed to another area, and discriminating in appraisal of the property, appraisal meaning the property value, how much it's worth, discriminating in that. And also discrimination in advertising is prohibited by the act, meaning one can't go out and advertise a home for a married couple with no children because, like I stated earlier, familial status is protected.
Right.
And refusing to make or allow reasonable accommodations in the home if you have a disability. Handicap is also protected. And so if there's something that you need in order to live in your home as a disabled person, you are allowed to make those accommodations, or you are allowed to request the home seller or the landlord, if you're a renter, to make those accommodations. And while they do have to be reasonable, you're entitled to those accommodations being made. And also threatening, coercing, or interfering with anyone who exercises a right under the act is prohibited. Therefore, if you find yourself being discriminated against and the person is trying to, you know, lead you to not file a complaint or threaten you, saying that you won't get the home if you complain about it, that's illegal under the act as well. And the agency that enforces the act is the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's a U.S. agency, and it's more commonly referred to as HUD. And if you find yourself being discriminated against, you can write a complaint to HUD, and then HUD will notify you as well as the discriminating party when they receive the complaint. And then they will conduct an investigation within 100 days of receiving the complaint. And after this investigation, if HUD determines that there is discrimination under the Fair Housing Act, then they'll have a hearing within 120 days, and hopefully the discrimination will be resolved. They will a lot of times try to come to an agreement between the two parties, and if not, then it'll be heard basically in a trial or a hearing. And also, I also want to mention, while HUD protects those seven classes that I mentioned earlier, there are also state and local acts and laws that are similar to the Fair Housing Act, And so those state and local laws may protect even further and greater classes than HUD. For example, in D.C., there's a law that protects based on vouchers, if someone received vouchers, based on sexual orientation, therefore if there was a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender person who wanted to acquire a property or acquire a home, and they were discriminated against because of that. And there are a host of other reasons why one will be protected under these local acts. But the Fair Housing Act protects those specific seven that I mentioned earlier, and I'll just state them again really briefly. They were race, color, national origin, religion, gender, familial status, and handicap.
Right. Wonderful. Now, I have a question, because I guess if some of those would be things, but how would you know, like, say, for instance, that it, let's say I go to apply for a house, how would I know that someone else received something that was different than what I'm getting?
You know, often that's one of the problems, so to speak, with enforcing the Fair Housing Act, because now, lately, like, discrimination isn't as blatant as it may have been in the past.
Right.
And so it's in those terms and those loans. So a lot of times it's very hard to prove, so to speak. So you would have to basically just kind of suspect it, and then you would file the complaint with HUD, and then they would do the investigation.
Right. So if someone feels like maybe perhaps they sort of got that feeling, you know, is there a way to really file a complaint, I guess, or maybe not a complaint, but maybe a concern? Like, is there a way to check and balance and say, I want to make sure that the interest that I'm being offered is being offered to everyone? Is there public information that people can get their hands on?
Well, I'm not quite aware of any public information that will be, like, readily available as far as interest rates for a specific area or a specific community.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually kind of, like, industry knowledge, and that's what's, again, is hard about it, is the fact that the average consumer doesn't have access to that knowledge. And so usually it comes from talking through friends, or sometimes it's a little later in the home buying process that you discover that this interest rate is higher than one that, maybe, you know, if you talk to some other homeowners or you talk to some people in the neighborhood, and this is kind of the way that people find out about these things, not always, because, of course, they're not going to tell you. Go ahead, Charles.
Sorry, I was going to add into what Jalen was saying. Also, it's really difficult because individuals have different credit scores, which trigger different interest rates. So usually the sellers like to hide behind that, because everyone has a different situation. So,
right.
Like I said before, the credit scores play a major factor in the interest rates and the terms and agreements of the contract. So it's really difficult to assess if you've been treated unfairly for that reason also.
Right.
I just wanted to add, too, that there's the National Fair Housing Alliance, and if you think that you might be subject to discrimination, that could also be a resource that you could use to try and determine. We had a speaker come and speak to our clinic about some discrimination that happens, and for the most part, like Jalen and Charles have said, it's very hard to know individually whether or not you've been discriminated against, but the National Fair Housing Alliance collects data, and they can tell you whether or not there's discrimination in your area or discrimination based on your race. So that's one possible resource.
Right, so that's another way to go. Okay, it sounds great. Lots of good information, especially for people now because of what's going on with the housing market. So what's next after you know all of that good stuff?
Well, actually, there's another act I just wanted to go over really briefly that's also very important when it comes to purchasing your home, and it's the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, and it's called RESPA.
RESPA.
And, yes. And specifically, RESPA applies to, it regulates closing costs and settlement procedures. And so it's a part of HUD's mortgage reform, and it really helps consumers to shop for the lowest cost for a mortgage. And so RESPA, basically, the gist of it is that it requires several disclosures throughout the closing and lending process to be made to the consumer so that they are aware and can have sort of those checks and balances that we were trying to get at earlier. And so some of the disclosures that RESPA require before, like when you're getting your loan, they require that the lender provide you a special information booklet which contains consumer information about various real estate settlement services. They also require a good faith estimate of settlement costs, which lists all the charges that the buyer is likely to pay at settlement. Now, while this is only an estimate, and the actual charges can differ. If the lender requires the borrower to use a particular settlement provider, then the lender must disclose that requirement on the good faith estimate. And also, it's good to have, because if at the final settlement you discover that those costs have changed, it's more likely that you're aware of it and that it'll be brought to your attention immediately. And then you can ask questions about why those costs have changed, just to make sure that there's a legitimate and legal reason as to why they've changed. Like, that's what I was trying to explain earlier. Sometimes later on in the process that you'll realize, well, maybe this is discrimination because you have these checks
right,
now coming
right.
from other acts and requirements. And good also there's also the mortgage servicing disclosure statement, which basically discloses to the borrower whether the lender intends to service the loan or transfer it to another lender. And it provides information about complaint resolution. So,
and you know what? That is a big problem, because actually that happened to me. My mortgage got transferred when I purchased my home. So that is really, 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 that's something to look into, because it kind of took me by surprise. Like, wow, what do you mean you're transferring my mortgage to somebody else?
And it's required that they disclose that under the Real Estate Settlement and Procedures Act. And another big disclosure that's required under the Act is the HUD-1 statement. And that's the statement that you get when you're preparing to go into your closing. And it's a standard form, and it clearly shows all of the charges that are imposed on you, the borrower, and the sellers in connection with the settlement. And so you're allowed to get the HUD-1 statement up to a day before the actual closing. And then the settlement agent must provide the borrower with a complete HUD-1 statement based on the information that they know at that time. And another disclosure that's required under the Act is the affiliated business arrangement disclosure. And it's so that it requires that whenever a settlement service provider is involved in this RESPA covered transaction, and they refer a consumer to another settlement service provider, and those two providers have some type of ownership or beneficial interest in each other, then the borrower, it has to be made aware of that.
Okay. Maybe you can break this down a little bit clearer for us.
Right.
Yeah. Let me see. I want to make sure that I have this. So if, okay, say it one more time, or just try to kind of break it down. So basically they can't have like some personal interest going on, like maybe they work together, they own another company together, they're family.
Right. And it's not that they can't have that interest, but they have to tell you, the borrower.
So say, for instance, maybe I'm purchasing a home, and the person I'm purchasing the home from, what about if they send me to their title company, and that title company is also owned by the wife of the building?
Right. Well, that necessarily wouldn't apply, because the person who you're purchasing the home from is not a part of the settlement. They're not a settlement service provider. A settlement service provider would be, for example, the title company, the lender, the attorney, the inspection company, the appraiser, the mortgage broker. Yeah, if there are those types of relationships among those entities, then that entity with those relationships has to disclose that to you.
That's
only if they refer you to that other entity that they have that relationship with.
Right. So, like, let's say, for instance, the appraiser who appraises my home tells me this is the title company to go to.
Right. Exactly.
And that couldn't be his wife without him saying, my wife owns this title company and maybe you should go with that.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Good
right.
Stuff.
And it's also that they have to tell you that there's that relationship, and they can't require you as a condition of providing that service. So they can't say, well, I'll only do this if you go to this company with whom I have this relationship. So that's another part of that.
Okay. All right. Great stuff. Great stuff.
Mm-hmm. And then really quickly, I just want to go over some of the borrower's rights that everyone who's interested in buying a home should be aware of, and that is that they have the right to shop for the best loan for you and compare the charges of different mortgages and brokers and lenders. Like we keep having this reoccurring thing that it's a buyer's market. So this is really the time to just shop for that loan, get the best rate that you can because the ball's in your court, so to speak. And you have the right to ask for the good faith estimate, which we talked about earlier.
Right.
You have the right to know which fees are not refundable. So if you decide to cancel the loan agreement, you won't be surprised by those things. You have the right to ask your mortgage broker to explain exactly what the mortgage broker will do for you. So, for example, you're the buyer, and the mortgage broker is supposed to set you up with a lender. And you want to know exactly how they're going to do that. What are their terms? What do they do exactly? How do they go about it? Are they a national company? Are they a local company? You really want to ask those questions and get information.
Okay.
And you have the right to know how much the mortgage broker is going to get paid, and you have the right to ask questions about charges and loan terms that you don't understand, and you have the right to a credit decision that's not based on your race, color, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, or any other category that may be protected under the federal law or local laws. And so these are just some of the rights and some of the laws and regulations that buyers should be aware of because they can really protect you if you know them on the front end and you know what's required of all of those who are involved in selling you your home.
That's right. That is. And really good stuff. Lots of good stuff, especially now because there are so many programs out there to help first-time buyers, and we'll get into some of that a little later in the show as we continue to have the form here. Lots of great information. Wow, I needed you guys when I purchased my home.
And Ms. Lou, really quickly, I just wanted to give a website that's very helpful. The HUD, I mentioned the agency earlier, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And they have a website with all of this information because I know it's a lot for us
right.
to be talking about it, but, you know, people can go to that website and they can see it themselves, and if they have further questions, they can delve into the website. It's really full of information, and the website is
www.hud.gov. www.hud.gov?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, lots of great stuff. Well, we're going to continue on in just a minute. I know you guys have some questions out there. We will be taking your questions very shortly, but we want to continue to move on so we can get through the next thing to do if you're in the market to buy a home, or perhaps you're renting, or perhaps you have a home, and these are just some good checkpoints for you. So I will let you guys continue.
Okay, so I think next we're going to talk about shopping for a loan.
Yep, we're going to talk about financing and how you would get your loan to buy your home. So first I want to talk about some alternative methods. Most people are going to buy their home through a loan, some type of loan product, because most people can't afford to pay for the full cost of the house outright, and so that's why most people pay with a loan. But you might also consider some alternative financing, just as a possibility. One of the ways is to look at foreclosures, and while that's not necessarily an alternate financing thing, it's an alternate way to find your home. And it's really sad that foreclosures are such a big market right now, but the truth is that they are, and that oftentimes you can find a home for less than you would have previously, and so the foreclosure option just offers a good way that you can find an alternate way to finance your home. But if you are going to do that, you should definitely do your research on the foreclosed properties. Oftentimes they can have a cloud on the title, so there can be more than one person claiming ownership, or there could be back taxes, or there could be previous mortgage issues from the owner who was foreclosed on. So you want to make sure that if you are going to go that route and try and find a foreclosed house, that you do your research and know ahead of time whether that's a good option for you or not. Another alternative financing option is the rent-to-own option. If you, in the way that starts out is that you would start out with a lease, and usually it would run for 1 or 2 years. So you have the lease, and it's of the home, apartment, condo, whatever, you know, housing that you're a part of. You start out with the lease, and you would maybe pay a little bit more than the rent actually requires in exchange for getting a credit for your down payment when you decide to purchase the house. So say the rent is like $1,000, you would pay maybe like $1,200 or $1,400, and that excess you would ask the owner to apply towards a down payment when you decided that you wanted to purchase the home. And so this is a good option for someone who's looking to purchase but is not necessarily in the market or able to purchase immediately. So if you want to try and build up your savings, or, you know, build up slowly the amount that you would pay for the down payment, this would be a good option for someone. But you just want to make sure that the house or condo, whatever, you know, type of housing it is, you want to make sure that that is the house that you actually want to purchase, because those excess payments that you make that would apply as credits towards your down payment, they won't be refunded if you decide not to actually purchase the home. So it's a good kind of delay tactic, but you want to be really sure about it if you are going to take this this route for financing. Another alternative financing method is owner-seller financing, and that is where usually with the loan process, the buyer works with the bank, and the bank pays the seller the cost of the cost of the house, and then the buyer repays the bank through the mortgage. But in this, the owner-seller financing, you kind of cut out the bank as the middleman. And so the buyer and the seller work directly in terms of deciding how the buyer is going to pay off the mortgage for the house. So it's a much more specific, a specific method than any other type of loan product or process, because it's working, you know, directly with one individual owner and one individual buyer. So this, because it is so individual, you want to really make sure that you have someone who knows what they're doing. You know, if this is your first time getting into this type of financing situation, you should probably definitely talk to a real estate lawyer who can let you know what the laws of the state are, things to keep in mind, and who can help you structure the contract so that it's, it has the best terms for both parties involved.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so those are the main alternative financing methods that I saw. I'm going to talk about more of the traditional types of financing, which is loans. And an important thing with loans, like Charles said earlier, is your credit. And so just so that people are aware of what constitutes good credit, when you go to you can find your FICO score.
Okay.
And your FICO score, it'll break down what qualifies as good credit, what doesn't. And so the credit range is from 300 to 850. And so basically anything above 620 is considered, you know, pretty good credit that any type of lender would probably work with you. Anything below that will be considered poor, and you'll be much less likely to be able to get any type of loan product. You can probably get it through some of the non-traditional or non-conventional loan organizations, but it'll still be it'll be difficult for you. So like Charles said, when you're figuring out how much you can afford, you want to make sure that you rehab your credit so that when you do start the home buying process that you're in a position where you won't have to, you know, get a more risky loan because your credit isn't what the lenders want it to be. But just so that people know what qualifies as good credit, like I said, between 620 and 850 is going to be considered good credit. 850 is a perfect score, which I think probably no one, you know, very, very few people, I'll say very few people probably have that type of credit score.
850. And you want to kind of give us, if you could really quick, just sort of a breakdown for those that are really not sure how the credit scoring works. Do you have some
right
information you can share on that?
I do. So if you have a credit score that's 700 or above, that's going to be considered excellent or very good, and you can probably get all types of discounts when you're in the loan process. A lender's probably going to be more than happy to work with you. Between a 680 and a 699 is pretty good. You can get a normal loan. You probably won't get as many discounts as, you know, someone above you might, but you're still going to get a pretty good loan product. From 620 to 679 is going to be okay. The terms won't be as generous as the, you know, the higher credit scores, but you won't be denied credit. So you can still get in pretty good, around that area. And if you have a 580 between a 580 and a 620, you're going to be near prime, and so that you will probably get an okay term, but because, you know, your credit score is risky, you haven't been on time with paying your bills, it's going to make the lender more wary when he's lending you money. So the type of loan product that you'll get will have, you know, like maybe a higher interest rate or, you know, terms that that will let the lender feel more comfortable in giving you the money, to know that he has, you know, a recourse if you aren't able to pay it back. But that's pretty much the breakdown. So, you know, 620 and above is going to be pretty good credit. 700 and above is excellent. 680 to 699 is good. 620 to 679 is okay. So that's just, you know, some things to think about with your credit score.
All right. Great stuff.
Yep. So let me talk about now, in terms of, like, loans, it usually breaks down between government and conventional loans. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the two main government loans that you can get. There's FHA and VA loans. And FHA stands for the Federal Housing Administration. And so that was an organization that was created to expand home ownership. And the way the loan works is you don't actually get a loan from the FHA. Rather, the FHA insures the lender against default. So if the buyer, you know, gets a FHA loan and then they default, then the FHA would pay back the loan to the lender. So
right.
It makes
now,
the...
Will you talk about who qualifies for these loans and if there is some special things you need to do to get them?
Right.
Okay, perfect. Go ahead.
So in terms of eligibility, one of the interesting things that I found is that with this program, there's no limit on income. So anybody really can apply for this program. And so usually you think of, you know, assistance programs as limited to helping,
right,
you know, lower income or middle income people, but this one has no limit on your income, so anybody can apply.
Okay, and this is the FHA.
The FHA, correct. Mm-hmm. The only kind of, you know, I guess kind of limit to that is that you have to have acceptable credit. So in terms of the breakdown that I just mentioned, the lenders are still going to want you to, you know, fall within that acceptable range of credit scores, but you won't be denied just because, you know, you don't have like a 700 plus credit score. But the program entitles you to approximately 97% financing, which is really good. And the eligible properties that the loan covers includes 1 to 4 unit structures. So you can use this to help you pay for your down payment. And when you apply for the FHA, some of the things that you need to have with you when you're applying is to make sure that you have the address where you lived for the previous 2 years, your employer's name and address, plus the amount of your gross monthly salary, your W-2s and income tax forms for the past 2 years. So just make sure you get all that stuff ahead of time if you decide to, you know, apply for an FHA loan. But just quickly, I want to talk about some of the benefits of the FHA loan, which make it, you know, a really attractive product. It's easier for you to qualify, like, and that relates to your credit scores. You know, because the FHA is backing it, the lender will be more likely to make a loan to someone who they wouldn't without the FHA's involvement. So you can have less than perfect credit and still be able to get an FHA loan while you may not have been able to get a conventional loan. Another good thing is that there's less cash that comes out of your pocket. So, and that applies to your down payment and your closing costs. So the down payment for the FHA is usually less than 5%, and the average number is like 3 or 3.5%. So, you know, say, for example, you have a $100,000 loan, 3.5% is $3,500 as opposed to 20%, which is $20,000 for a conventional loan for the amount of your down payment. So with an FHA loan, you could save like $16,000 to $17,000 in terms of the amount of the down payment that you have to make. So that's, you know, that's definitely something that's really attractive, especially if your, you know, your liquid income is kind of tight and you don't have that type of money to pay out, or, you know, to have to, you know, finance in some other way. But the only limit on that is that you can't have discharged a bankruptcy within the past 2 years. You can't have had a foreclosure within the last 3, and any outstanding debts or judgments or any other payments that you need to make those, pay those in full before you close. And then another good thing about the product is that you can use gift funds to pay for your down payment or your closing costs. And so I'll get more into gift funds when I talk about conventional loans, but basically you can't use gift funds to pay for down payment or closing costs with a conventional loan. Two other good things is that there's counseling that's available before and after you purchase with the FHA loan. So, you know, there's other counseling that's maybe available like at cost, or you may not be able to get it, or you may not know about it, but counseling comes as a part of this loan. So you have someone who's there working with you and helping you try to figure out, you know, what's going on, what questions do I need to ask, things like that. So it really helps you in the process to have someone who's on your side and will be able to counsel you before and after purchase. And then the final thing that I think is a really big benefit is that the loan product offers lowered closing costs, and it's usually like between 2 and 3%. And they can also be built into the mortgage. So like the down payment and closing costs are usually upfront fees that you have to pay when you're working with a loan. And like I said, it's usually 20% for conventional loans, and then closing costs are whatever percentage of, you know, the cost of the loan. But you have to pay those up front, as opposed to like if you got an FHA loan, you could work that into the total amount of your loan. And while it would result in maybe a higher, you know, loan amount, it would be easier to pay it back because you didn't have to pay it up front, and you could pay it off, you know, over a longer amount of time. So, you know, for those people who don't have the money to you know, pay a big chunk for a down payment and then pay another big chunk for closing costs, this is an attractive option. And then the final thing that I think is a benefit is that you can have co-signers. So a co-signer would be a non-occupant co-buyer that is allowed for qualifying purposes. So like for someone like me who's coming out of school, you know, if I couldn't afford to get a loan, but I could ask, you know, a parent or someone to co-sign with me. And then once I got my income, then I'd be able to pay for it. But so you're not completely denied from being able to get a loan because, you know, you yourself can't qualify. You can use a co-signer to help you qualify. And then some of the drawbacks of the loan is that there's loan limits on you know, the amount of the loan. And so the way that works is that HUD puts out an annual loan limit amount, and so based on your area, based on the type of house that you're getting, there's a loan limit for you know, for how much the FHA loan can cover. So you can find that at HUD. And I went to HUD and just typed in a place that's, you know, I did Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland, and it's divided by county or state, but the amount of it varies. So if you type in, you know, Montgomery County, it gives you the loan amounts. Like for a one family loan, it's like $729,000 is the loan limit. So basically you would need to find, if you wanted to get full, you know, financing for this type of loan, you would have to find a house that's $729,000 or below. Because if you find a house that's more than what the loan limit is, then you'll have to cover that difference yourself. And so I'm not sure if you have to cover the difference or if, like, the FHA just won't make the loan. I doubt that it wouldn't make the loan completely. I think you'd probably have to, you know, cover that difference yourself. But, you know, part of the reason why you're doing the FHA loan is because, you know, you need the money, and it's not likely that you could cover a big gap between, you know, the loan limit and the cost of the house. So the amount, it varies by location, so you want to go to HUD and figure out, you know, where you are, what the loan limits are, and see, you know, whether or not that's going to be, you know, the house that you're looking at is going to fall within the loan limit of the FHA. So that's the main drawback. And the FHA, it offers, you know, the same type of loan products as conventional. There's fixed rate, adjustable rate, graduated payments. And then the other thing with the FHA is that there's allowables and non-allowables. And so that just means, like, what the seller or lender must pay for versus what the borrower must pay for. And so the borrower is usually going to pay for, you know, regular closing costs. So should I go into conventional loans now? So I'll talk a little bit about conventional loans. Conventional loan products, they're usually backed by Fannie and Freddie. And so Fannie and Freddie are government-sponsored organizations, and they do the same thing as the FHA and the VA. They're loans that are backed by a party as opposed to loans made directly. And I forgot to go into VA loans, so I'll just cover that, you know, right quick. So VA loans are, it's limited to certain parties. You can have veterans that receive VA loans. You can have active duty. You can have reserve troops. You can have the surviving spouse of a vet receive that are eligible to receive this type of loan product. And it offers really good rates too. Sometimes you can pay no money down. It has usually a lower interest rate. And, you know, the seller or builder can pay almost 100% of the vet's closing costs. The only drawback is that it also has loan limits, and there may be a funding fee that's involved. So now I'll go into more so of the conventional loans. And conventional loans are usually we'd get those from any type of lender. And like we were saying earlier, you want to shop around for a lender and see, you know, who has the best product so that you're not, you know, that you get the best product that you want to get. So I'll just go into, because I found it particularly helpful to know, like, who some of the parties were. So the lender is either the bank or, you know, the person who's actually giving you the money. And the broker is some type of company that's like the middleman that's working, working through the bank to get you the money. There's different types of loans that you can have. There's the fixed rate. And usually the loan term is either 15 or 30 years. And so that's usually the loan term, and it can vary. Like if you have the shorter loan, you might have a lower interest rate or higher monthly payments. If you have a longer loan, you might have a higher interest and lower monthly payments. And then one thing to think about in the beginning of the loan process is getting a pre-approval letter, and that just lets the lender know that you're serious about making the purchase, and it tells the lender what you can afford, and, you know, just shows them that you have the money to be able to make the purchase. but you should realize that the pre-approval letter, it's not binding and it's not required. So that's one thing that we learned from the Fair Housing Alliance, is that, you know, that sometimes there can be discrimination against Blacks and Latinos, that, you know, that they try, that a lender might require a pre-approval letter from them, but it's not actually required. So that's the main part about loans that I wanted to talk about. It's more specific to working with a lender, but keeping in mind, you know, like that your credit score plays a big role in it, and, you know, the amount of money that you can afford plays a big role in it, so that when you go to speak to your lender, you should be aware of, you know, of what you can afford, and don't let someone pressure you into, you know, buying something that you can't afford. So finally, I guess I'll move into home buying programs. And these are really, they're more specific to, you know, your area. So you want to check your area and see, you know, what type of programs are available in your area. But some of the ones that you can think about is, you know, the FHA, which offers you, you know, lower down payments, and they're a good option for first-time home buyers. You can think about housing counselors that'll help you figure out how to manage and pay off your debt and start saving. You can also think about HUD. They provide assistance programs. There's AmeriDream, which is also a pretty good, you know, reputable organization. There's a Good Neighbor Next Door that works with certain types of people. So there's different types of home buying programs, but you want to, you know, figure out what type of program that you're looking for, and then contact the organization that you want to work with. Usually, the program is in the form of a seminar or some type of online program that you work with, and then they, you know, they'll provide you that assistance that you need. So that's my piece about home buying programs. I think we're going to move to shopping for a home.
Yes, we are. And basically, I think this is the part of the home buying process that most people get most excited about and that they think about first, although those other things should all be considered before or while shopping for a home. So basically, when you start shopping for a home, you want to choose a real estate agent if you decide to go with a real estate agent. And usually I think that it's best to try to go with a real estate agent, because sometimes the market can be a bit overwhelming and they might have access to and know about houses that you may not be able to find on your own. So, but also you want to be careful when choosing a real estate agent, because you want someone who is knowledgeable about housing and who knows about the market and who knows about different consumers and the types of homes that they might like. So you want to start by trying to get personal referrals. Talk to your friends who may have purchased homes, or talk to your people in your community, or people at your job, or people at your school, or people at your place of worship to try to find out about their real estate agents, or you may know someone who is a real estate agent. But you want to get those referrals, because there are tons and tons of real estate agents, but you want to get one that's going to be the best for you. And once you find a few real estate agents, you want to kind of conduct interviews with them. You don't want to necessarily have a formal interview in a rigid setting, but you do want to ask questions to find out about their experience, about their commitment to practicing real estate, and about their education. And you want them to have at least 2 years of experience, because as you can see from the process, the steps that we've mentioned so far, the home buying process is more complicated than one may think. And you want to know that they have a commitment to the job, and that they'll be committed to working with you throughout the entire process to actually seeing a home being bought and your dream of owning a home coming into fruition. And you also want to check on their education, because with real estate agents, there's not a lot of formal education that's required. It varies from state to state, but it can be as little as, let's say, 40 hours of training and a multiple choice test. So you want to see if that agent has gone on above and beyond what's required of them and got extra knowledge and are really knowledgeable about the home buying market. And after you've chosen your real estate agent, and actually probably you've been doing this already, but you want to actually write down and create a wish list. Just think of all the things that you must have in your house or things that you would like to have, and think in relation to every aspect of your prospective home, your community, your neighborhood. These are all things that will make your home most enjoyable for you. So some things you might want to consider are what part of town the home may be in, the price range, school systems, if you have children of that age, the age of the home, because older homes may require more maintenance. Newer homes may not be as characteristic as some may like, and you want to consider the type of home. Would you like a condo in a building amongst others, or would you like a two-story single-family home or a ranch style? You want to consider nearby recreation, shopping, nightlife, things of that nature. You also want to consider public transportation or parking if you drive, because some areas, and D.C. is one of them, where parking can become an issue if you don't have the proper registration and permits for your car. You want to consider the size of the house and the size of your family or the size that you may need for whatever it is that you'll be needing to do in your house. If you like to entertain, you might consider that. Consider the number of bedrooms, bathrooms, the house's features, such as hardwood floors, carpet, those types of things. And you also want to consider other features in the community. For example, homeowners associations are something that may have a big impact on the home that you buy. You want to request a copy of the homeowners association rules and guidelines so that you can review those before making decisions, because sometimes they can limit or prohibit things that you can do with your home, and you may not be aware of those until after you buy your home. So you want to review that before you actually purchase. And while you're thinking about all the things that you want and must have, you also want to think about things kind of in the negative, things that you absolutely will not deal with in your home or things that you would not like to have to live around. That can be just as important as knowing the things that you want and must have. And so after you've done this, it's a good idea to prepare a housing checklist that lists all of the factors that you've decided upon, and consider taking that with you to each home that you view. So that way, when you come back and you're reviewing the homes and you're thinking about the decisions that you have to make, you'll have that checklist there to compare and contrast and really choose the best home. Another idea is to take pictures of the exterior of the home, and if it's allowed, of the interior. In that way, you can have a visual reference to review along with your checklist. And you also may consider fixer-uppers. It's basically homes that have a lot of work to be done, but sometimes those homes, it can be well worth it because you can get exactly what you want, and oftentimes you can get the home at a lesser price. You also may consider manufactured or mobile homes, and you may consider even building a home from scratch if that's what suits your needs best and if you are able to financially do that. So I think that next we're going to discuss.
And just if I can interject just for a minute, because you brought up some very, very good points and some things to think about, especially when it comes to, and this may be leading to your next point, especially when it comes to if you decide to have your home built from the ground up and you're actually dealing with the builder. So the agent, a lot of times that you're dealing with in some states, because I know the state that I'm in, they're not required to have any license as long as they're selling for the builder. And so you have to know that the interest there sometimes is, it may not be in your best interest, so you do need to come with a lot of questions, like a lot of the things you brought up about the schooling and, you know, what can be
what can you have? And a lot of times people get caught in that, and they're dealing with the agent who actually works for the builder versus
right.
them being, working for some, some national chain, Century
right.
21 or someone like that. And also mm-hmm. you said something else that I think is very key to consider. Could actually go down to your local police department and find out what the crime rate is in the area next to you
yeah.
or the area you're in. So let's say, for instance, if maybe you're building in a new subdivision, cul-de-sac, or the particular area is just being developed, you can find out what the crime rate is for the surrounding areas.
Right.
And I think that's something good. So it's so much stuff. I took a lot of notes because you really just, wow. Like I said, when I purchase my next home, I definitely will review all of this because it's a lot of good stuff. And as far as the Homeowners Association, one of the things I think is very key that you brought up is that you do need to know those terms and conditions
right.
because some of them can be very strict. I mean, as strict as, believe it or not, you
mm-hmm.
cannot paint certain
colors,
like if
yeah.
there are colors in your house. If
that's
you're
right.
buying a condo, they may tell you that, oh, you want to take out carpet and put in hardwood floors,
right.
you have to get approval from them to make those kind of changes.
Yeah.
So it is important that you understand. And if you're a homeowner, they may tell you you may want to have a particular type of grass in your front yard. Let's say you want Bermuda grass, and the Homeowners Association may say, no, that's not the grass you can have. It may
right.
need to be Kentucky bluegrass. You cannot
right.
put that grass there. Maybe you own a boat. And sometimes when you don't have your boat stored somewhere, you want to park it in front of your house on your street. That may be against their policy. You cannot do that in the neighborhood you live in. So
mm-hmm.
these are things that sometimes we get so happy, like you said. And it is a great thing to own a home. I know it's been certainly wonderful for me. But it's a lot of things that do come with that. So you do have to look at the negative. I thought that was excellent. Some great
mm-hmm.
points. So I hope everybody out there is really, really just kind of taking notes like myself or go back and download the show. Excellent job to everyone. So I'll let you guys continue. You're doing a great job.
Okay, thanks. So next we were going to talk about making an offer. So after you've done all those things and you kind of found the home that you want and you're satisfied with that, then it's time to make an offer. And so I think that Charles, am I correct, is going to talk
right,
about
this. This is one of the most exciting parts of the home owning process, making an offer. And you want to discuss the process with your real estate agent. If the seller counters your offer, you may need to negotiate until you both agree to the terms of the sale. Be sure that you're serious before buying, before making an offer, because if the seller does accept your offer, it becomes a legal contract after a few days. Now, there are only
Let
two
me,
steps
Charles.
In making.
Charles, I just wanted to interrupt you for a minute. If anyone has their speakers or computer speakers off on the call, make sure you turn that off. We're getting a little bit of feedback there, or step away from the computer. I apologize,
okay,
Paul.
Sure. Okay. Essentially, there are only two steps in making an offer. Step one is negotiating a sale price. Negotiation is a standard practice in real estate, and sometimes it's something that your real estate agent will do on your behalf. So you want to learn more about this process so that it can work for you. The second step is making an offer in writing. It's really crucial that you understand what should be included in your offer. Details and planning are really important. So you should know what you would like to pay, but also think about the most you're willing to pay and the total home financing amount that your lender has pre-approved you for. Be specific, and I also encourage you to put everything in writing. This is the time when you put pen to paper and specify how much you're willing to pay for the home and under what conditions you will buy, for instance, repairs requested, move-in date, etc. Now, a written offer on a home usually includes the following information. It usually has a complete legal description of the property, usually includes down payment and financing details, proposed move-in date and closing date, and also the price that you're offering. Also, you want to make sure that you make a smart offer on the home. When calculating your offer for the home, you should consider several factors. For instance, what homes sell for in the area, the home's condition, how long it's been on the market, financing terms, and the seller's situation. by this time, you should also have a good idea of how much you can afford to pay for each month. Work closely with your agent when making a purchase offer on the home. It's a critical part of the process and not something that you want to rush through or handle on your own. One of the factors I mentioned previously is determining the market. I think it's really important that you check the temperature of the market and determine if it's a hot market, a cold market, or a neutral market. Like we've been saying earlier, this really is a buyer's market, so you'll likely have less competition for the home. And usually when we have buyer's markets, sellers will be more likely to be receptive to any offer because there are fewer buyers. But if you're buying in a seller's market, sellers might not consider any offer that is less than the list price. In fact, sellers could very well receive multiple offers, which means your offer should be as attractive as possible to win acceptance. If you're in a hot real estate market where houses are selling fast, you want to get your home buying offer to the seller as soon as possible, and your agent's expertise will prove invaluable in such circumstances. Now, before making your purchase offer on a house, compare the house to recent sales in the area. Your agent should have this information readily available. If the seller's asking price is above recent sale prices in the area, you should bid lower than the asking price, citing this difference as your reason. It's really important to find out also how much the seller paid for the house. While it's true that in many cases the price the seller originally paid for the home has little bearing on today's market, however, if the seller purchased a few years ago in a depressed market with little appreciation since, the asking price should be closer to the seller's purchase price. So it's really important that you check how much the seller paid for his or her home. Although you might not be able to figure out the condition of the home when the seller purchased it, nor whether the circumstances were extenuating, you can still adjust for increases due to appreciation and remodeling improvements. The next factor you want to consider when making your offer is you want to determine the seller's mortgage balance on the property. Unless the seller is in default and willing to participate in a short sale, the seller is unlikely to accept an offer for less than the mortgage plus closing costs. If the seller has an extremely high mortgage balance and the property is vacant, you can assume that the seller is making those mortgage payments out of pocket, probably paying on two homes. And if the mortgage balance is very low, the seller might not be motivated to immediately sell and can afford to wait out the market to get the price he or she wants. Lastly, I'd encourage you to be prepared and negotiate and have a plan for doing so. For instance, you need to have a plan and you need to be ready to act if the seller turns down your initial purchase offer for the house. Additionally, you need to have a plan and you need to be ready to react if there are multiple offers from different buyers and a bidding war develops. So you should consider these possibilities before making your initial home offer or home buying offer and have a plan in place for each scenario. And, of course, when in doubt, you should follow your agent's advice. So now we're going to actually Lois has a few points she wants to add on.
I remembered that I planned to mention about the difference between the gift funds for a FHA loan or one of the government loans versus for conventional loans. And I just wanted to mention that gift loans aren't allowed in a conventional loan, just so that the lender knows that the buyer is serious and that some of the sources that you have to use for making the gift loans is that you have to use your personal funds like checking your savings account to pay for your down payment or your closing costs, because it indicates to the lender that you're serious about, you know, buying the home and making the loan. So that's just one of the things that I forgot to mention about the difference between, government loans versus conventional loans.
Okay. All right. Very good point. Can I be heard?
Yes. Yes. So I think very, now. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm sorry, you guys. For those of you out there listening, you're listening to the students from Howard University Law School, and they're talking with us about that subject that has been brought up so much about home ownership and your rights, the rights that you have, whether you're purchasing a home, renting a home, or whatever you're doing, all of these things. You're live in the Remix, and of course, I'm your host, Miss Blue. Okay, you guys, you may continue.
So next, I think the next step was Jalen wanted to talk about getting a home inspection?
Absolutely. Now, this is very important, to get a home inspection. And actually, you should make your offer contingent on that home inspection, because the inspection can really tell you about the conditions of the home. You know, it can really help you avoid, like, buying a home that needs major repairs if that's not what you're willing to do with the fixer-upper, like we talked about earlier. And a home inspection can also protect you, the home buyer, if there are major problems that aren't yet there but are likely to occur. So basically, for your protection, you really need to get a home inspection. And during the inspection, what will happen is a trained inspector who is impartial, and this is, again, one of those times where you want to make sure that this person isn't linked with either the buyer or the lender or anyone else in the home buying process. They need to be an impartial party, and they'll look at the property that you plan to buy, and they'll evaluate the physical condition, and then they'll identify items that should be either repaired or replaced. And it's up to you and the buyer to identify or to decide who's going to repair and place and replace those items. And then they'll also estimate the remaining useful life of any major equipment in the home, of the structures and finishes in the home, and also the major systems in the home that are like electrical, plumbing, heating, air conditioning, things like that. And you really want to have this. I cannot stress the importance of having a home inspection. And you also want to ask your inspector some questions. And some of these questions that I have listed here for you to ask are, what does the inspection cover? So basically, it should ensure that the inspection and the inspection report will meet whatever requirements that your state may have, and it should comply with these standards of their practice and their code of ethics or whatever is required, because it varies from state to state. So you want to make sure that you ask what the inspection covers and then sees that it complies with what's required in your state. And you also want to ask the inspector how long they've been practicing in the home inspection profession. Now, while the inspector themselves may be new to the profession, as long as they have a team or an associate or a business partner who they work with who is more qualified, then it should be fine. They should provide a sufficient and thorough inspection of your home. And you also want to ask them, are they specifically experienced in residential inspections? Because residential inspections can be different from construction or engineering or different types of inspections that an inspector might have to provide. You want to find out, do they offer repairs or improvements that need to be made based on the inspection? While the answer that you get will vary from state to state, you still want to find out this information, because it can sometimes be a potential conflict if the inspector also offers repairs or improvements and if those repairs or improvements are to be paid for by yourself. Because what can happen is, to essentially make more money or get more business, they'll offer repairs or improvements on something that might not necessarily need to be repaired. So you want to find out that information, and if they don't offer the repairs or improvements, that's fine as well, but you want to kind of evaluate the answer that they give you in light of your specific situation. And you also want to find out how long the inspection will take. The average inspection usually takes about 2 to 3 hours. So anything that's much less than that, it may not be enough time for a thorough investigation. And also, just remember that this is just general knowledge. So if you have a small condo that you're buying that needs to be inspected and it was built a year ago, now that would take maybe less time than, say, a huge old historic house that has acres of land or something like that. So you just want to know what you're dealing with. And you also want to know how much the inspection would cost. Typical range is between $300 and $500, but again, that may vary based on your location in your state. You want to find out the type of inspection report that they provide and how long it'll take to receive the report. Usually you can get a full report within 24 hours of the inspection, and you also beforehand want to ask for samples to make sure that you can understand the inspector's report and their reporting style, and to make sure that you're able to ask any questions if you need to do that. And also you want to find out if you'll be able to attend the inspection. And it could be a good educational opportunity about the home that you're potentially going to buy, and it can just really show you some things that even though the inspector might not notice, you yourself might notice and either second guess or confirm your decision to purchase this home. And if the inspector refuses to allow you, it might raise a red flag, because if there's no foul play, then, you know, why shouldn't you be able to go? So you want to ask that question, even if you don't necessarily intend to go, but you just want to know the answer to that question. And you also want to find out if the inspector has membership in a professional home inspection association, and that, again, will vary from state to state depending on their regulations of the inspectors. And lastly, you want to find out if the inspector has participated in any continuing education to keep his expertise up to date, because there's always new developments in home inspection and basically anything related to housing, and you want to make sure that you're getting the best and latest and most up-to-date knowledge, information, and inspection.
All right.
So next we're going to talk about shopping for homeowner's insurance. And that's after you've had your inspection and you feel comfortable with purchasing your home, then you want to try to find out how to and where to get homeowner's insurance.
Okay, so I'll talk just a little bit about homeowner's insurance. Basically what it does is it protects your house from against disaster. So you want to check the area that you live and see, you know, what is typically the type of disaster that might be, you know, common for your area. Like if you live in Kansas, you might want to get tornado insurance or something like that, like wind insurance. You know, if you live in a floodplain, you definitely want to have flood insurance. So you want to, you know, it varies by location what type of, coverage you're going to need. But usually when you get the insurance, you want it to cover both your home and your contents, so that if something does happen to your home, it will cover the cost of repairs, you know, for anything that happens to your home, and it'll also cover the contents of your home. And there's usually some limit that you put in the policy that says how much you think the contents of your home is worth. So that's what the part of the insurance will cover. And so the rates vary based on, you know, the cost of your home and then also the cost of the contents of your home. It's one of those things that it may be required to pay at closing, because if the lender wants to make sure that the house is protected during that first year, so he may require that the first year, the amount of the policy for your first year is paid up front. There's So when you look at homeowner's insurance, there's usually four types of coverage. There's one that covers the structure of your home. So like I said, that relates to the repairs if anything happens. Another type relates to personal belongings or contents, so that if, you know, your house is destroyed by a tornado, that you won't not only lose, you know, the house itself, but the contents, so you can get that covered. There's liability protection, and that protects you against lawsuits for property damage or bodily injury that's inflicted on you or others. You know, so basically, if anything happens in your house and someone, that you will be protected against liability. Then the final one is the cost of living elsewhere if you have to move out of the house. So it's kind of like incidental coverage. It'll cover hotel bills, restaurant meals, or other living expenses that you incur while your home is being rebuilt. And usually the policy will cover about 20% of the insurance on your house, but the number can be, you know, changed at your request. So when you think about the amount that you need, you want to make sure that you there, I mean, there's no, you know, hard and fast rules about the amount that you need, but you want to make sure that you can cover the cost of, you know, the replacement of your home and or the contents of your home so that, you know, you're not out any money if something does happen to your home. But you should, when you're looking for it, you should definitely shop around. You can probably get the same, you know, homeowner's insurance through, if your bank offers it, you might be able to get it from your bank. I know with the renter's insurance that I have, I get it through the same banking agency that I'm with. So you might look at, you know, policies that you already have and whether that organization offers homeowner's insurance. You might think about raising your deductible so that, you know, the more that you pay out, it'll help in terms of what's actually covered. And you don't want to confuse what you paid for your home with rebuilding costs because, you know, the cost of your house and when you buy it versus the cost of rebuilding, if there is a disaster, can be different. You also want to look if you can get some type of group coverage, you know, like through a professional or alumni or business group to see if they have some type of, you know, some type of package that they can offer you based on, you know, your status in a particular group. And you want to seek discounts too because, you know, I mean, discounts are always better than non-discounts, but, you know, just try and get the best rate that you can. And another thing too that you should think about after you have purchased the home is ways to make your home more disaster resistant. So, you know, if you live in a place that has windstorms or natural disasters, you want to add storm shutters or reinforce your roof or, you know, buy stronger roofing material so that, you know, you don't have to rely on the homeowner's insurance to protect you if a disaster does happen, that you've, you know, taken some independent steps to make sure that, you know, your home is protected, you know, just if anything were to happen so that the homeowner's insurance didn't pay, you know, based on the damage or the amount that it provided you wasn't enough. So just make sure you take steps to try and protect yourself ahead of time. And the same way you can do that, you can improve your home security, you know. So if something, you know, nobody ever wants their home broken into, but, you know, if you install a, you know, an alarm system or like a sprinkler system if there's a fire, then in that way, you know, you help yourself to, you know, to not have to, you know, put yourself at risk. You're taking precautions ahead of time so that you don't have to rely on the insurance. And another thing that you can do is stick with the same insurer. You know, if you have an insurer that that you've worked with, you can renew with them. They might be able to give you discounts, and that'll help you, you know, in terms of the cost of your policy from year to year may change, or it may stay the same and probably even get better. Another thing you want to do just to make sure that you're protecting yourself is review the limits in your policy and the value of your possessions at least once a year. You know, if you've made a big purchase, you know, if you've bought that big screen TV and you paid like $4,000 or $5,000 for it, but you don't have that amount included in your homeowner's insurance, then if something were to happen and that's not covered, then, you know, you may be out that money and the TV at the same time. So those are just a few of the things to think about with homeowners insurance. You know, just keep in mind the amount that you may need is personal and particular to you. So the last step that we're going to go to is signing the papers, and that's Charles.
So when you sign the papers, you're finally ready to go to settlement or closing. It's really important that you read everything before you sign. You don't want to sign unless you understand what you're signing, obviously, and the house is completed the way you agreed on, and there are no outstanding bills for work done in your new home. At the closing, there will be a mound of paperwork for you to sign. And I understand that you have the right to read every document either at closing or before. Ask the title company to get you a copy of all of your closing documents 24 hours before closing and then take the time to read them. You also want to ask questions before you get to the table. Sometimes it's not a quick thing to fix an error, so the more you know before closing, the easier it will be. This is your loan, so this is your loan that you'll be paying off for a long time, so make sure you understand your responsibilities before you sign the papers. Also, many experts advise that you shouldn't sign before the house is completed. A new home will always have a callback list, and little things here or there that need to be touched up. However, if there's something major that's not done or something major that's not done to your satisfaction, you should think about calling a lawyer. Once you sign those papers, it can be become very difficult trying to get something corrected by the builder. So remember that they have their money at that point and other homes to build. So until you sign and they have their money, it'll be easier to get their attention. So it's just really important to sign only when you understand all the information, all the terms and agreement, and everything is done to your satisfaction. Again, because at this point you are creating a legal contract that is binding on you. Jalen, did you also have additional information to say about signing?
No, everything that you said was just really great, and I just wanted to make sure that they were aware that you can get the HUD 1 statement for the actual closing where you sign the document and review it, and that you can ask those questions to your attorney if you have one, or to the lender or the mortgage broker, whoever you have questions whoever you have questions for, you can ask them, and you can get that up to a day before. But also, even if you get it the day before, read it again the day of, because you never know what could be changed or what could happen within that 24-hour period. So that's just really important to read mm-hmm. that document and
right.
one statement.
Right. And I think it's also some excellent points, especially if you're having a new home built, and I'll just speak from experience, to really mm-hmm. do a final walkthrough. Most of the time they will give you that final walkthrough before you go to closing. And you're right, if there's anything that is not to your standard at that particular point, it could be something as simple as maybe they're putting the wrong color carpet in, maybe the light fixture you initially put in is not there, and they will quickly, a lot of times, not all builders, will say to you, don't worry, we can fix that. But I was very persistent in saying, no, before I go to closing, I would feel better that these things are taken care of. Little touch-ups, things like this, like you said, because you're right at that point of really just seeing your dream come true, and sometimes you can get caught in that and just it really kind of bypass things. But later, they can turn out, like you said, to be a nightmare, because once you sign those papers, they are obligated, but depending on the state that you're in, some of those things will be considered to be now your responsibility and not the builder's responsibility.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, are there any questions that we could take from listeners? Or?
Yes, and actually, everyone out there, if you're listening, I have been having some natural disaster things go on in my particular area. I hate to say it like that, but we've been experiencing some power outage. So I actually have not been on the call for maybe the last 30, 40 minutes. And so I'm going to try to see if there is a way that we can take questions. And I want to say thank you to everyone out there listening for your patience. But this is the reason why I haven't been able to really respond to you and get the questions and do the calls. But I am trying to make my way back there, and hopefully I will. And then we can open the last couple of minutes of the show for questions. So while I'm doing that, I will ask you guys a question, and we'll keep this in this way, and we'll get to all the questions. If someone is about to purchase a home right now, and they're thinking about really just going out and purchasing a home. Let's say they're in the position where they're able to put down cash, a lot of cash. Is that something that you think is advisable to do?
Cash, putting down just cash, I would probably say is not the best idea. You know, if, because the process is the contract, you want to make sure that you put your money in some form that you can have it be documented how much you paid. So maybe you want to put that cash into an escrow account and say, you know, this is the money that I have for the down payment. You could do it that way. So if you're talking about just cash and like giving someone cash, then no, I wouldn't recommend that. But if you're talking about a large amount of cash to use for your down payment, you can do that, or just a large amount of money for your down payment, you can do that. But just also keep in mind that, you know, the down payment is one of those upfront, you know, sums of money that you have to pay as well as the closing costs. So one thing that you can do with a down payment, if you're getting a conventional loan, is usually the conventional lenders will require 20% for a down payment.
But, right.
Most people can't afford that. Like, you know, if you have a $100,000 house that you're purchasing, 20%
right.
for your down payment is $20,000. You know, that's
right.
a lot of money for someone to come up with, you know, as one chunk of money that they have to pay in addition to some other chunk of money that they have to pay. So you can possibly get mortgage insurance where you pay so much of the down payment, and then the mortgage insurance company will cover the other part, so that the lender will, you know, the down payment to the lender will be satisfied, but you just have to pay back that amount that the mortgage insurance company will cover. So, you know, that's one possibility, is just to put it into escrow and have that, you know, big chunk of money for your down payment. Another option is to split it and have some go to your down payment, have mortgage insurance cover the other portion, and then use some that final portion to pay for your closing cost, or just use it all to pay for your down payment. So,
Okay, great. And now I'll tell you something else, and I'm almost back, you guys. I'm almost there, I promise you. Wow. But here's something else that you can speak about, because I'm going to have to transition over just to come back. But why don't you talk about escrow, because I think that could be a little tricky. A lot of times you see people say you can purchase a $200,000-something home and only have a mortgage payment of $40, but there are some other things that sometimes I think people don't realize when figuring the amount. You know, interest rate, of course, is going to be impacting, but there is also your homeowner's insurance. There's, you know, property taxes. I don't know if you guys spoke about it while I was gone from the show, but if not, if you can talk about how that number can really fluctuate a lot. And did we speak on ARMs and what that is and why that's not a good thing for most people who want to be in their home longer than possibly a year?
I guess I can take that. I did a little on escrow, so I don't really have a whole lot that I can offer for escrow. But you can use escrow that it'll help you pay for, I guess, if you're talking about like what other things, like what other charges or you know, money you might have to use to pay. You can have an escrow account to pay for, you know, real estate taxes or hazard insurance, and possibly mortgage and flood insurance. But, you know, from my understanding, escrow is just a way to hold money so that you have it, so that when, you know, when a payment needs to be made, that, you know, with the agreement of the parties, that the payment can come out of that escrow account. I don't know if Charles or Jalen have anything else to add to it. But I'm sorry, I missed the second part of your question, if you can repeat that.
Yeah, okay. Whew, I think I'm back, you guys.
Okay, good.
Oh, wow. Live radio, you got to love it. Okay, well, you know, when I was talking about the escrow, like say for instance, it depends on the type of mortgage company that you go through, but I know, and don't quote me on the act, but there was an act that was passed so that you could make sure things like property taxes were taken care of. You can make sure things like what homeowner's insurance was taken care of. And all of these things were taken care of through through your mortgage company, which takes the money each month. You pay a portion of that goes towards your mortgage, and the rest of it will go towards taking care of these things for you, taking care of having enough money for your taxes and having enough money to pay your insurance every year. And so what I was saying is that somehow you may start out with, let's say, a $600 mortgage, but because of these other things coming into play, now your mortgage may be over $1,000 a month based on your property tax, because that is something that does not it has nothing to do with the interest rate rising. And sometimes people think, well, as long as I get a fixed interest rate, then my mortgage is going to stay the same. Well, your mortgage can actually be impacted by your property taxes.
Right, and that's why, you know, looking at your property taxes is was one of the critical factors that a future homeowner should consider when they're
exactly.
figuring out how much they can afford. This is a really tricky element to predict with a home purchase, especially with housing costs going up so dramatically in recent years. And like you said, they're levied by various municipalities in which the house is located, so it's really hard to predict in advance.
Right.
And I did want to make one another quick note on, I think the act that, Ms. Blue, that you're referring to may be the Settlement and Procedures Act, which does require that the lender at the settlement give you an initial escrow statement, and basically that statement just itemizes all the estimated taxes, insurance premiums, and other charges that are anticipated to be paid from the escrow account. And like
right.
anticipated. So,
right, exactly.
As I was saying, it's kind of, you know, tricky to predict these things, and but they are required to give you that initial account. It's anticipated the amounts to be paid from the escrow account during the first 12 months of the loan. And so it also lists the payments and any payment amounts that may require, like, a cushion for it. And then
that's
after
right.
that, they have to give you the annual escrow statements once a year. And that's the same thing in the annual escrow account. Summarizes all the escrow account deposits and payments during this 12-month year. And it also notifies the borrower or if there are any shortages or surpluses.
That's
so I guess
right.
that's one way you can kind of know what's in escrow or how much needs to be there or if you're owed anything back through those statements that you're supposed to get from the loan servicer.
Right. I think that is that was kind of a tricky point for me. I will tell everyone your first year of purchasing a home, and this is some real stuff, depending on the time of year that you purchase your home and at the time of the year when your property taxes are due, that can be very tricky and misleading because you haven't actually been there a whole cycle, a whole year. You haven't been there. And so it gives you the impression that maybe your mortgage is going to stay at that particular rate because based on the property taxes, you're only charged from the time that you actually became the homeowner of the home. And then after, I believe it's your first 12 months, there are in certain states, and I'm not sure you guys will be more of an expert in this particular area, but there are certain acts such as I know in Texas they have the Homestead Act, which really covers you and you're able to really kind of get sort of a discount, if you would, on paying those property taxes on structural damage. You're only going to pay it on the land. And so that first, I'm sorry?
Oh, no, go ahead and continue.
Okay. So on that first year, your property tax may only be a couple of $100 because you're paying it based on the time that you took over the ownership of the home and until the time that you actually, until the taxes are due. Well, that next year, they're going to also include structural taxes. So that means you're paying it on the full structure. That can go from a couple of $100 to several $1,000s, just depending on what state you are, because it is going to vary. It's going to depend on the property taxes. So it is also good, and I'm sure you guys have touched on this, but I just wanted to stress this point, that not only do you get in touch with all of these other agencies, but you also definitely want to get involved with your local city government as well to find out those things, you know, find out what the property taxes is, what are they doing, what kind of building is going to go on in your particular area, because depending on where you purchase your home at, that ultimately could impact how much property taxes go to, because they will give you a statement, the state will, and it will break it down and tell you, you know, it will give you a breakdown and it will explain to you, like, how much is going towards if you live near airport, road development, your school, your public education. And there are some discounts that you can receive based on your age and different things mm-hmm. you've done in your life.
Yep, that's true. There are Homestead acts in most states. I know in D.C. there's one. They offer Homestead tax deductions for first-time home buyers. And they have them, I believe, in most states. But they do, and that's a good point, Ms. Blue, for home buyers to look up the Homestead Act and the Homestead deductions, because a lot of times you do have to take affirmative steps to apply for and actually receive these deductions. They're not automatic, so you should look those up in your state and then do whatever is required to get that deduction on your property taxes.
Okay, beautiful. So now, everyone, if you have questions out there, we can take questions. I see there are some callers on the line, but if you have a question that you would like to ask in the forum, please give us a call at 646-652-2711, and we'll be able to take your call. Caller from area code 708, you are live in the Remix. Please tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Hi, everybody. My name is Danielle. I'm calling from a Starbucks in D.C. No, but I'm a student, and I'm about to graduate. I was calling to see what you guys think about people who have student loans and, I guess, obligations that they need to pay, considering coming out of school and purchasing something, maybe a foreclosed property, or, you know, how do you feel about that, and whether you think we should wait a while, try to save some money, or should we go ahead and jump in and, you know, get a foreclosed property and start renting? What do you guys think?
Well, I think it's definitely based on your financial situation. If you're going to get a conventional loan, then you should realize that there will be money that you have to pay up front, you know, for the down payment. Or if you're getting, like a FHA loan, something like that, just realize that there are, kind of like Ms. Blue said, there are more costs up front or like in that first year that you will need to think about. So, you know, for someone coming out of school similar to myself, I don't have the cash flow to be able to, you know, feel comfortable in paying a down payment and then also have to pay for, closing costs and taxes and all the things that come along with home ownership. But at the same time, lots of the books that I've read say don't let your lack of money, inhibit you from thinking about or, you know, taking steps to purchase a home. Lots of times with, you know, conventional lenders, they want to see W-2s for at least 2 years. So, you know, maybe one thing you might do is consider the rent-to-own option where you could possibly be paying, you know, your rent and have those credits, accumulate to help you make a down payment, or work with some other type of, you know, down payment assistance program or like mortgage assistance program that'll give you, provide you with some of those funds that you may not have. So it's something to consider, you know, coming out, you know, especially because the market is how it is now and it might change, you know, within 2 years. But it's really something that you have to take a look at your financial situation, what you can afford, and, where you think you'll be at the end of, you know, the year in terms of financially and where, like, making your home purchase.
Okay, thanks.
All right. You're welcome. Great question. Now, everyone out there listening, listen, you are able to actually go ahead and call in so we can continue. We have about 7 minutes left in the forum here, but we will continue to stream and we'll continue to talk. So if you want to hear the rest of the conversation, you're going to have to definitely call in before the 7 minutes is up. 646-652-2711. And I'll say that again, 646-652-2711. Just go ahead and call in, and you'll be able to continue to chat with us today. Oh, okay. All right. So, everyone, welcome again to the forum, and we're going to continue the discussion. And so those are some very, very good questions, lots of good points about people. What about if someone is maybe in the market thinking about selling a home? What kind of advice would you or information would you suggest that they do?
Well, as far as someone considering selling their home, I think especially in today's times, patience is, I would believe, the number one thing that they would need to have, because as we've been mentioning throughout the show, this is a buyer's market and there are a lot of homes for sale, whether it be for foreclosure purposes or whether people are relocating or whatever the reason may be, there are a lot of homes for sale, probably more homes for sale than people buying them. But for a buyer, you also want to do the same thing kind of as a as a, excuse me, as for a seller,
you also want to do some of the same things as a buyer would do. You want to look into getting a real estate agent of your own, because oftentimes people, a real estate agent can really help you in terms of getting your house to the people who may be most prepared to buy your home. You also want to look into where you would be going next as far as, are you purchasing another home, so then you yourself would be in a buyer situation. You want to look at getting your house prepared to sell. You want to, you know, make sure that you kind of fix up things that need to be fixed up to make your house the most attractive that it would be to a potential buyer. And I'm not sure if maybe Lois or Charles have anything to add.
Also, I think if you're a seller, you also want to keep in mind just how detailed and specific the listing contract is. You want to make sure you include everything from including the price and terms of sale and also the real estate commission. And my biggest piece of advice would be, especially in this market, is just to be willing and able to negotiate with the buyers, because it is a buyer's market right now, so they kind of the ball's in their court.
I was just going to add, too, for a seller, they might think about if they're in the position to maybe renting out their home instead of trying to sell it. So that will give them some type of money coming in, as opposed to, you know, selling a house that was valued at $100,000 and now it's selling for $50,000, you know, and taking that loss. So maybe think about renting or some other type of option that will give you, you know, money coming in and you don't have to sell at a loss.
Right. Right, and I think that is probably because you see a lot of the signs. I know I've seen them. First the house goes for sale, then all of a sudden the sign changed to lease or to rent, because that, you know, right now in this particular market, it is definitely a buyer's market. So lots of options, and depending on what your income status is, depending on a lot of times your income status that you are, you may qualify for some first-time buyers programs that are in your particular state. So, again, this is a good connection to have with your city and state. You may also want to check with your bank, because the banks, you know, believe it or not, one of the misconceptions that probably came out at first is that the banks were really trying to take people's homes, but now they don't want them. They can do nothing with them either. So there's a lot of programs that's going to be coming out that, you know, we should all just keep our heads up for, and to see if you're in the market to purchase or maybe you're thinking about it, this will be a good time to kind of shop around and do that.
Right.
Yeah. We have just under 2 minutes left to go in the forum. What I'm going to do for the last few minutes of this show, if you're out there listening and you're a guest, you're always free to register so that you can participate in the chat room over here on Blog Talk Radio. Make sure you come back and sign up for the shows. We do a show every Friday night at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, right here live in the Remix. And, of course, with me, your host, Miss Blue, you're welcome to join us. And then we have these very, very special shows that we do with, like we're doing today, from the students from Howard Law School and Howard University, which is actually one of the best schools in the world, if I must say so myself.
Yeah, we would agree with you.
I must say so myself. So what I would like for you guys to do, we will be doing another show with Howard University. So for those of you out there listening who really enjoyed this, we will be back. And when is that, in April? What day did we set?
April 11th.
April the 11th. We will be doing a show with Howard University. So make sure you mark your calendar for that show. And we will be talking about...
That one we'll be talking more so about home foreclosures and what you can do, you know, after you've bought your home, and if you unfortunately were foreclosed upon, you know, the remedies that you have to be able to get you out of that situation.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to take some callers. We have just under a minute to go in the forum, but we will continue to stream. If you would like to listen in and continue while we go just a few more minutes, call us at 646-652-2711 now. Okay, that's if you're listening now. All right, caller from area code 202, you're live in the Remix.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a question regarding post-purchase and I guess protecting your legacy, if you will. A lot of folks go in and make purchases and don't have wills. And I know I've purchased homes before, and they've been in probate, and they last forever. How can buyers, new home buyers, protect the legacy and the investment of their home through legal procedures where they would need an attorney to protect their homes, because a lot of people don't deal with wills? And I'll take the answer offline.
Okay.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned the best route that you should take is to, you know, put your home in a will. A lawyer is probably the best person that you can get to do that. But at the same time, there are some online sites that will help you create a will. Thinking of LegalZoom in particular, that will help you not only, you know, for your legacy, but also for your current protection, to make sure that, you know, there's clear ownership of the home, and that when you or your spouse pass away, that it will pass on with clear ownership and in the manner that you want it to pass. Because one thing that a will does do for you is it gives you the it allows you to define how you want your property to pass. If you don't have a will, there's state statutes that determine how property passes. So, you know, if you wanted your house to go to your sister and you didn't have a will and the statute in your state said that your house passed on to your child, then, you know, you wouldn't have any control over who your property gets passed to. So definitely having a will is probably the best way to protect your legacy and, you know, and to have your home pass the way that you want it to pass upon your death.
Right. Very good. Well, everyone, it has been an incredible, incredible show. And right now we're streaming this show, so for those of you who may be listening to the archives or you're on the phone listening, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. It is, wow, so much information. I would really strongly suggest that everyone downloads the show. You can come and you can sign up for the feed, whether you want to follow the show on Twitters or whether you want to go to if you want to go to iTunes and download it, you're more than welcome to do that so that you can get the show. Pass it on to someone you know. Lots of great information here, and I cannot thank you guys enough for coming on board and sharing with me today.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Last words. I want you guys to give me a big shout-out in your last words that you're sharing with everyone, just about you and what sort of your mission in life is going to be and what you plan to do once you do graduate and leave the law school, Howard Law School, and what is you're going to move on to do.
Well, after I graduate, I'll stay in D.C. and I'll be working for the government, but ultimately, I would like to work with economic redevelopment in the Black community and, you know, empower us in that way through, you know, an increased economic stream. So that's my, you know, ultimate goal.
Beautiful.
And, well, me, after I graduate, I'm going to be going back to Michigan and taking the bar there. And ultimately, I would like to work with similar interest to Lois, but work with community development and low-income housing, as well as other types of property, including intellectual property. So that's what I would like to do.
Oh, beautiful.
And right after I graduate, I'm going to be studying for the bar exam. And after I take the bar exam, I plan to go abroad for a couple of months just on a volunteer mission, probably teaching English in a third world country. And then when I return here, I plan on staying in the district. And I also have some intellectual property interests, so I'm not exactly sure, but that's what I'm thinking so far. But.
Okay, that sounds great. I look forward to you guys doing some great and wonderful things, and make sure that you stop back by and, you know, share that with me. As always, it's always an honor. Make sure you guys, you thank our contact over there. I don't even know if he wants me to give his name out on air, but... Thank him so much for the connection and having you guys come over. It's always a pleasure. And even though we had a few obstacles here today, it's no different than the obstacles we'll face in life. We must face them head first and overcome them and not run away from them, but face the challenge head on, and we did that today. So thank you so much, Lois, for your support, because that's how I was able to get back onto the show and continue to streaming. So I just love you guys so much, and I really will definitely want to keep in touch and see all that you're going to do in the world, because you're doing some wonderful and incredible things now, and, you know, just keep focused and continue on your mission and your path, and I know that greatness is ahead for all of you.
Thank you, Ms. Blue.
All right. Well, everyone, that's going to conclude this episode of The Remix. It's just been really a beautiful, beautiful way to start out my day. And so I just want to thank you guys for joining us here in The Remix. To close us out, we're going to go ahead, and I'm going to sing one of my favorite songs here, and I know it's one of yours, too, and that is I'll Take You There. So make sure you have a wonderful weekend, and maybe you need to take somebody there.
No.
peace and blessings to everyone. Have a wonderful weekend. Ashe, hetepu.